Today on the Top Shelf, we have Ryan Dahl, creator of Node.js and Dino. And in this episode, we talk about some of the origins of Node.js all the way to the origins of Dino and really what makes it much different from Node from Ryan's mouth. And of course, we cover Dino 2, the recent release, and all the things he's really excited about with JSR and the changes to the ecosystem that Dino is really frontiering. Also, today's sponsor is CodeRabbit. More on that later. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Top Shelf. My name is The Primogen, and unlike me, the number 19th most followed account on GitHub, we have less well-known open source contributor, TeejDV, coming in at a lowly 282. Our guest today is Ryan Dahl. He is the creator of Node and Dino. Ryan, thanks for being here. Pause. Let Ryan say something.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Awesome. So Ryan, obviously the question that's on everybody's mind is, what will you do when Dino passes Rust as the most starred Rust project, even over Rust itself?
I feel like we were there at some point, but recently Rust has retaken the number one spot, but jumping into Rust when we started Dino was kind of a leap into the darkness, and actually turned out really well. And I'm happy to be continuing to work on this project many years later, and happy with Rust, and happy that we are probably one of the biggest Rust projects in the world. And I guess number two starred on GitHub.
Yeah, I think one of the things we wanted to talk about, so that's great hearing you already talk about it, is I know when you first wrote Node, obviously you're writing a lot of C. Then first time when you started writing, I believe Deno at the time, but now Dino, it was in Go, and then now it's in Rust. Share a little bit of your thoughts, particularly from our side. I think we're interested in, okay, sure, sometimes it's fun to start writing a Rust project, but then, something changes, you've got to redo everything. How do those things scale over time, working with a team as more people get on? Just interested in a lot of your thoughts there.
Sure. I'm not sure I've said this before, but one of the reasons that I stopped working on the Node project back in 2012 is because Go looked so good. And, my goal with the Node project was basically to solve server programming. And I was just like, wow, Go is basically exactly what I want. And I started tinkering with it, as one does. Everything looks really great from the outside. Once you start digging into the details, there's more and more problems. But I long ago, I think maybe starting in like 2014 or so, started tinkering with Go plus V8, and had probably the first Go plus V8 bindings. It was called V8 Worker, and it was just kind of toying around how you could kind of create bindings to this JavaScript language. And when I went to make this kind of off the cuff conference talk, the 10 things I regret about Node talk, I grabbed my V8 Worker Go bindings off, basically just off the shelf, and threw the TypeScript compiler in there, and just threw together a little runtime for this conference demo just to kind of prove out a few points. Couple months later, like, it became clear that there was quite a lot of interest in a new JavaScript runtime and kind of rethinking first principles. And at that point, it's like, okay, well, if I'm really going to continue this, is this really the best foundation for this? And the thing that was worrying me is that Go has garbage collection and V8 has garbage collection. And having both of those things in the same process at the same time, while not causing problems immediately, like, seems like it could be pretty problematic down the road. Graydon, who's a friend of mine from LiveJournal days, has been making this Rust language for like many years, and I sent him a message and was like, oh, I think I'm going to use this, and he was like, yeah, it seems like a good idea, started playing around with Rust and never looked back. Like, it's super obvious to me that I'll never start a new C++ project. Like C++ is just dead in my mind. You know, the thing that people love, the thing that I love about Rust is maybe not the memory safety and, you know, advanced type system stuff. I mean, all of that stuff is good. What really levels it up compared to C++ is just a unified build system and mm-hmm. a unified package manager, and the fact that you can just kind of pull in third-party dependencies so easily, and you know, get essentially be able to control the assembly as much as you desire.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I was quite interested to hear if it was primarily like garbage collection related or language feature related that sort of made you leave Go and go into Rustland. So that's really interesting. How do you feel Rust has, because you started early on Rust, so obviously you've gone through a lot of pain points, I'm assuming, in Rust changing as a language quite a bit as you have been using it. So maybe talk about some of those transitions and also transitions within the company writing a very large Rust project.
Honestly, it's been smoother sailing than you would think. I think Rust is incredibly fun to work in. So it's been really, I've been able to work with a lot of great people who, you know, simply just want to work in Rust and work on hard problems in Rust. So, you know, finding people to work in it has not been problematic. Like everybody who wants to work in Rust are like really great programmers from the outset. I think pain points is compile time. Honestly, that's you know, as the project grows, we have, God, northwards of, I'd say 600, maybe even 700 crates in Dino at this point. So it is a large project, and compile times can be bad, especially if you get LTO in there, and you know, that last link step for a release binary can be like, I don't know, like 8 minutes. It can be pretty bad, but we're able to deal with it. We've got a CI that runs on every commit, and we're creating binaries for a bunch of platforms, and you know, you just have to think a bit more about caching and stuff. But other than that, like I feel like kind of growing pains with Rust have been not crazy bad. Like it's been pretty smooth sailing as they've released new versions.
Prime, I think you're muted. We can't hear you.
Sorry about that. Okay. My fault. So I'm trying to like mute myself so you can't hear me. Did you ever have any opportunity to look into Zig? And if you could go back, would Zig be an option today?
I haven't actually used it in earnest. It looks very much like C is to C++ as Zig is to Rust is kind of how I imagine it. Looks pretty nice. But I mean, I'm so deep on this big Rust project that haven't actually given it a chance. Looks okay. Nice.
So I have a tweet that's behind us, so you can't really see it. TJ's partially in the way. I'll read it for you. It says, in Bun, you can use ESM and require in the same file instead of spending your valuable time rewriting code. Now, obviously, Dino from the outset has been very bullish on TypeScript. TypeScript is very bullish on import statements. They've kind of always been this direction. I believe they even have some custom syntax that is available only in the TypeScript version. Why did you make this choice of ESM only?
I mean, that is the language, right? That is the specified module system as of 2015. And doing anything other than that is working against the specification. And I mean, you can write something similar to JavaScript. You can write CoffeeScript. You can do all sorts of stuff. But I am not using JavaScript because it's like particularly beautiful, or that I agree with every syntax, or that like, I'm using JavaScript because that's what works in web browsers. And my goal with Dino is to stop the insanity that is happening on server-side JavaScript. Like the future of JavaScript, by the way, I think there is a long future of JavaScript. I think the it's just too deeply embedded in humanity at this point to like go away suddenly. I think it's much more deeply embedded than like Java is in humanity. It's just not going to disappear anytime soon. And it might actually be here forever, right? It might be here for a very long time. And the future of JavaScript is always going to be browser JavaScript. And you know, any deviation from that is only going to create technical debt down the road. So if you're using require and import in the same file, like, what can I say? Like, you are doing it wrong. And that is causing, like, maybe that's nice for a moment, but like, that is just causing pain down the road. So I am a strong believer that, we need to pay attention to the specification. I mean, specs can be broken. You know, server-side JavaScript is not a browser. You know, there are places to deviate. There are places where it's necessary to deviate. But in the module system, like, hard no. Like, I think we really need to leave CommonJS behind and settle on. You know, we're coming up on 10 years of ESM. It's like time to just stick with ESM. So yeah, Dino takes a pretty hard stance on this. That said, I mean, we now are supporting NPM modules. Like, you can import CommonJS modules in Dino, but it's a little bit like it's not available to you as kind of the top level developer. If you start writing require and stuff, you're going to be run into errors, but deep inside of Dino somewhere there is a CommonJS implementation to understand that code. But you know, that's just a backwards compatibility thing that we don't find super elegant.
So kind of with that, especially with the whole standards and wanting to stick to a standards, I know JavaScript types have been in and out of the standards. I forget what level it's currently at. I think maybe just only on one or whatever it is. If types were to be proposed and some sort of type hinting or type syntax is involved in JavaScript, how do you reconcile your kind of push into TypeScript, which is not a non-standard kind of feature or a non-spec compliant feature, and then sure. If something were to come out, how do you do that?
This is one of the ways where you have to kind of put a little grease on the Vaseline on the camera lens and blur things, because I think as programmers, it's pretty apparent that TypeScript is very useful, and it's pretty apparent that it is the way to add types to JavaScript, not Flow, you know, not some other weird system. It's definitely TypeScript. It makes you more productive. It's very pragmatic. I think that the types as comments effort is hopefully going to encompass TypeScript, right? Like the TypeScript syntax can actually be interpreted by browsers, and there's some open questions there about how to handle interfaces and enums and stuff. But you know, my hope would be that TypeScript ultimately is kind of the next version of JavaScript, and that browsers would be able to take TypeScript files and strip out the types, which is a fast operation, and execute the underlying JavaScript. Dino is kind of jumping ahead a little bit and you know, allowing you to program TypeScript and not, you know, it's kind of the balance of pragmatism versus ideals. And you know, in this case, TypeScript, of course, is not understood by the web browser, but we feel that this is ultimately where JavaScript will go with types as comments or some other system.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed how you talk about Dino and maybe some of the things you regret about how Node progressed was a deviation away from web standards in the Node world. And then like in Dino, there's sort of this big push from even, I think, just like on the front page about this idea of web standards. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the ways you felt you missed the mark on Node that you're rectifying in Dino, or even particularly in Dino 2?
I mean, I wouldn't say I missed the mark, because it was 2009 and there just was absolutely nothing. Right. So if you want to make a HTTP request, like you're going to do XHRs, like it's just terrible. So like there was some need to invent things just to, there's a need to invent a module system. And I don't necessarily regret CommonJS because it was just, that was, we just did something pragmatic to make it work. And yeah, frankly, CommonJS works pretty well. I think it's just like, as time goes on, there was not kind of a push to rectify that. Actually, there is now, right? I think Dino and Bun kind of create pressure on Node to actually address these things. But for many, many years, it was basically the stance that, you know, Node is done and it is what it is. And like, if you want fetch, you're going to have to like pull in some NPM package. And I think those things are changing these days. I think probably the failure was not setting up a proper charter for Node as it kind of progressed to like continually evaluate what's happening in the browser and like strive to reduce the gap between what's happening in server side. The module system, you know, frankly, it's our Python 2 to Python 3 moment, right? It's just a mess introducing ESM when there was in fact already a module system. And you know, I think you can kind of complain in retrospect. Again, it's been almost 10 years now since this was spec'd out. I think the standards committees, you know, TC39 and whatnot, kind of have, you know, they're often like aggressively trying not to break people, right? Like when they introduce global this instead of global, it's just like, oh my God, really, guys? Because there's like one website out there that has used the variable global. But and so, that, you know, they're very, very careful about not breaking people. And then at the same time, like they introduced like a whole new module system syntax that's like completely opposite of what, you know, the standard module system was at the time, that, you know, introduced, you know, 10 years of Python 2 to Python 3 situation. But it is what it is. You know, you can complain about that as much as you want. The standard is still ESM one can complain about the syntax and whatnot. I think we should still strive to meet what has been spec'd out, whatever that might be, global this or global. It doesn't quite matter.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I think one of the interesting things that you all recently released was JSR. I don't know if you can give everybody a quick overview of what JSR is, everyone might not be familiar, and then we can maybe camp out there a little bit and chat about JSR.
Yeah, JSR is a new JavaScript registry where you can share JavaScript code, just like the NPM registry. NPM has, post GitHub acquisition, has kind of stopped changing. There's no new features. It's just kind of wild because JavaScript as a whole is just very dynamic. You know, there's a lot of energy about it. There's influencers like yourselves and you know, people talking about this stuff all the time. And yet the place where everybody's publishing code is just at a complete standstill. It's not open source. Nobody knows what's going on with it. There's no new features. The language itself is evolving. There's a new module system. There's new runtimes and NPM is just what it is, right? A forgotten corner of Microsoft that they begrudgingly pay the egress bandwidth fees and, you know, keep the lights on, I guess. They're probably wondering what to do about it. I don't think it makes much money for them. So it's a public good, I guess, that Microsoft is doing. And don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm glad that the NPM registry is in a good place and a solid server that you can rely on and is, you know, you're able to download stuff from. But I think it could be much better. It could just be so much better. And like you can basically shake a stick at a dozen different features that you would want NPM to do. We just got tired of it and we actually did it. So JSR is a new open source registry It is delightful to publish to. If you sit down and code something, like you just write some ESM, you export some functions, you push publish, it goes up there, it autogens docs. It has a pub score, similar to the Dart registry called?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
It doesn't matter. That's right. I think it's pub.dev. It's delightful for consumers. You know, the auto-generated docs, the pub score. There's nice security features, and it's delightful for publishers. And especially when you get into TypeScript stuff, like you can literally just publish the TypeScript, and it's available there. It of course works natively, very nicely in Dino. You can just import JSR colon whatever. And that's all that's needed to add a dependency. But you can also pull it in Node or Bun or Cloudflare Workers via basically an NPM adapter layer that we have, where it does some trickery with scopes and adds an NPM RC file to your repo. But you can add dependencies on JSR to your Node project as well.
By the way, I must say that I love JSR because I cannot tell you how many times I've published to some private internal Artifactory or NPM registry and forgot the correct files globbing to make sure that my distribution files are the ones being correctly pointed to, the confusion with main versus what is actually my main file, the jump to definite. There's like so many things wrong with that entire ecosystem. And the worst one is the fact that I could publish something with files that are not anything to do with my project. And you just don't even really have a solid way to validate this. And so I just love, I really actually think the direction of JSR is fantastic. Kind of recalling my time in Dino when it first came out. So I actually have the Dino hoodie. It's sitting right there on the floor. I have the original one. Very, very excited about it. I do remember that it heavily relied on URLs for quite some time, if I remember all of that correctly. Why didn't that kind of scale? Because using Go, if I want a project, it just works off of a URL, but it feels so much cleaner. Like, why didn't that work the same way with Dino? Whenever I used it in Dino, I always felt confused at how to get the thing I needed to get.
That's right. So Dino's original module system was like dead simple. You had your local modules. You could do import.slash whatever. And then you could import an HTTPS specifier that pointed to some source code. So you could put some stuff up on Gist. You could put it up, you know, wherever you want. And that was the kind of distributed, registry for stuff. It's great. It works really nicely for small projects. And as we grew with Dino and started trying to introduce it to larger and larger projects, and as the years went by, a number of, in retrospect, very obvious problems kind of start poking their head out. You know, one is that a distributed registry sounds great, except that servers can go down, right? We know that npmjs.com is going to stay up because it's backed by Microsoft, but there's all these people creating, you know, their individual registries, nest.land things. And if you link to a dependency on there and that server goes down, well, then all the people that depend on that thing go down. And it just takes one dependency in your module graph to kill your project. And that ultimately does not reflect well on, that is not a good user experience, even if, you know, you can kind of wash for a long time I wanted to wash my hands of that and just be like, well, it's not my problem. Don't use random servers on the internet. Like, you should be using something better.
Good advice, though. That's good advice.
It is good advice.
Yes. good advice, but like in some ways, like the runtime, frankly, needs to enforce this to a certain degree. Having a centralized server is maybe not very webby, but boy, it sure helps developing software if you know that you can, you know, go grab a dependency anytime you need it from a specified server, and that there's, you know, high availability for for npmjs.com. Like, that actually adds a huge amount of value. So that was a big problem. There's a problem with versioning. For a long time, I was saying, and people are like, well, what about versioning? I'm like, well, versions are just a string, and URLs are a string. And so there's a subset of a URL that could be a version. And like, I'm, you know, who am I to judge what sort of versioning scheme you're using? Well, yes, that's true. But Semver is kind of nice, right? It's kind of nice to be able to take in patch versions and kind of have this auto upgrade and, you know, having some idea, having your dependencies not just be individual files that, you know, have no sense of versioning to them is pretty problematic when you want to have a security fix to some dependencies. So having Semver versions was an important thing. I think all of these thoughts of like how to make Dino's module system more robust led to JSR. And it's really a trade-off, right? I mean, the original module system was dead simple, and that has a lot of benefits to it. It means that if you're building tooling around that module system, like, you can implement that super, super nicely and super easily, right? If you're going to build a bundler or whatever, just go fetch those HEP remote specifiers. If you're going to integrate with JSR, well, it's more complicated because JSR packages translate into HTTP URLs, and they're nicer than it works in NPM, where all you get is a tarball. Like, you can access individual files, and you can just pull the files that you need, you know, as a consumer. But JSR can have NPM dependencies. And so that means that you need to be able to pull down NPM packages, and you need to be able to understand CommonJS. And well, once you start understanding, downloading NPM packages and understanding CommonJS, well, then your module system is not simple at all. Like, it is very complicated. But that seems to be the right trade-off, because, I mean, what are we trying to do at the end of the day? We're trying to make software for humans and make it usable and nice to use. And if the simple module system is too simple, then and people aren't going to use it, then it's not the right design.
So this is kind of a bit of a left field-ish type question coming at you here. Just hearing all this talk about module system and all that, and just thinking about my time both in Rust and Go and Zig, and there's something very, I think, magical about how Go does their package level kind of modules versus Zig and Rust and JavaScript, where you just have a lot of barrel files. You have like modrs, or you have all these things that kind of like barrel everything up together. How does... Do you ever like look back on that and wish that the module system wasn't at a file level? Do you wish that it was at a directory level, kind of like Go, or is it actually better to have it at a file level?
I would have previously said it's better to have it at a file level, because that's what ESM specs. Like, each file is a module. But I think practically that doesn't work very well. And in JSR packages, there is a sense of a package, which is a set of files. And, you know, there's an entry point to that. And there's a version associated with that. That just corresponds much closer to what happens in real life. I think this idea of like each file could be a module. I mean, each file is a module, and you in Dino, you can still pull in HEPS specifiers, you know, put something on gist and pull it into your project. But it doesn't scale very well with complexity. I think at some point, like, you really need to have a directory with the tests, and you need to have a bunch of different files that are all versioned similarly and kind of have whatever configuration kind of applied to that globally. And you want to do docgen across all of those things and not treat each utility module inside of that directory as a standalone package that has a standalone version. It doesn't map to reality very well.
Yeah. So kind of an interesting question, which is that if you've been paying attention to any of the kind of the WordPress drama of late, that there was an incident in which one of the packages was just overtaken, right? They owned the package distribution, and ACF became SCF, now owned from one company into the hands of another company. How do you kind of regulate or determine how you add, take over, and remove stuff? Because I know earlier TJ was streaming, and someone inside of his stream actually had the at Discord kind of like package group or whatever you call it, the field. I forget the exact name, scope for it. And so that was just, you know, that had to be taken from him. And I think everybody here would agree that some rando does not own or deserve to own Discord. Discord, the obvious choice, should be owning Discord because it's a huge attack vector. So how do you make that determination for when you take over projects, should you take over projects, all of that kind of area? Take it where you want.
There is a package on NPM called Dino that was created, I don't know, like 2 months after I started Dino. And it's just some trashy little package that is out of date and hasn't been updated for years now. And I think it's an attack vector. Like, you know, yeah. I'm sure people are trying to NPM install Dino all the time and not getting the right thing. And I have tried so hard for so long to get this package. I have tried legal action. I have tried trademark issues. Like, I have tried everything. And GitHub, Microsoft are just like, nope, we will not touch it. Like, we're not doing anything. I think that is a disservice to the community. Like, yeah. What are these registries for? Like, this is supposed to help us as programmers and supposed to be a public good that you know, a public service that we can all rely on. And I think having squatting scopes and squatting package names and stuff is not helpful. So we do take a different stance. We do not take a hands-off stance on JSR. We have reserved well-known scope names on JSR, and we do take away scopes from people who are found to be squatting them and give them to the appropriate people. Salesforce just messaged me this morning wanting to reserve their scope. If you can prove that you are, who you say you are, you're a representative of Salesforce, like, you will get the Salesforce scope. I think this is generally just, it's for the public good. It is like these registries should help programmers develop. I mean, what other purpose do they have? They are not, maybe it's not clear. JSR is not a commercial undertaking for us. Like, this is open source software and meant to be kind of openly run. It's, you know, currently run by the Dino company, but we are eager to kind of share the load here and get other people involved. By the way, if anybody's listening and wants to get involved with JSR, please reach out. We're looking to have more community managers and stuff on there. And yeah, I think part of that is just kind of taking a little, you know, just kind of being a little careful about who owns what packages. And you know, if it's very obvious, something like Salesforce, we're going to give Salesforce the at Salesforce scope, right? It's pretty clear. And on NPM, the Dino package should belong to the Dino company. Like, good God, there's no good that is going to come from this. I just don't understand.
Yeah, and there's not really any reason someone reserves Salesforce except to try and trick people that they're the real Salesforce. You know, it's not like, oh, exactly. What a common phrase that I like to use or something. sort of along this line, I know you've been a big proponent of talking about the JavaScript trademark situation. Maybe you'd like to give your pitch to the world about what's going on there and maybe how people can help out.
Yeah. People may not realize it, but JavaScript is a trademark that owned by Oracle. Of all companies, it's just kind of shocking when you learn this. This is because when Netscape was developing Netscape Navigator, like in 1997 or so, and Brendan Eich was adding JavaScript to it, they did a partnership with Sun Microsystems, the developers of Java. And they had this idea that JavaScript was like Java, but, you know, something that you could more scripty, I guess. but, you know, we all know that Java and JavaScript have gone in very different directions. They have essentially nothing to do with each other except some vague syntactic similarity. Because of this partnership, Sun Microsystems, I guess as part of that partnership, Sun Microsystems owns the JavaScript trademark. And when Sun was acquired by Oracle in 2006 or something, Oracle got the trademark. And they have dutifully renewed this ever since. Oracle, of course, does not make a JavaScript product. You know, they do have Grail VM, so it, you know, they're not entirely not working in the JavaScript space. But there are many JavaScript VMs, and I, you know, I think the main people working on JavaScript are Google and Apple and Mozilla, right? And not really Oracle as a main player. And in fact, if you go look through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office records for the JavaScript trademark, you'll find that they give some pretty questionable evidence that the JavaScript trademark is still in use. So, for example, in 2019, the most recent specimen that they gave for their JavaScript trademark was the Node.js website, which I'm like, no, sorry, like Oracle never paid me a dime for Node.js. They're, you know, I can say for sure that Node.js is not an Oracle project. And like, this is pretty questionable. As actually, I should take a step back. Trademarks must be used in order to be kept. There is a sense of trademark abandonment, which is codified in law. So like, if you don't use a trademark, it does go away. I think it's a period of 3 years or so. So there's effectively two ways of trademarks becoming abandoned. One is that you truly just abandon it and don't use it, which I believe is the case with Oracle. I don't think they have a product called JavaScript. And I think it's been more than 3 years. In fact, I don't think they've ever had a product called JavaScript. The other way is that the mark becomes a generic term. So think of like Kleenex, for example, is kind of a generic, a trademark that has become a generic term. I believe that's still a trademark, but there is actually a call out for this in law. And I think JavaScript totally qualifies as this. It is a generic term for the world's most popular programming language. It refers to multiple different implementations. In fact, there are, you know, TC39 manages the ECMAScript spec. And yeah, they had to call it ECMAScript because they had to avoid this trademark. Like the trademark, you know, doesn't really affect you as a JavaScript developer in your everyday life, but it does create all sorts of kind of headaches and problems. You know, for me as running a company that develops a JavaScript runtime, like, you know, we have to ask ourselves, can we say Dino is a JavaScript runtime, or are we or is Oracle going to sue us? And in fact, Oracle does occasionally reach out to people and say, hey, don't use JavaScript, right? There cannot be a JavaScript conference because, yeah, you can't call something JavaScript. This is not what trademarks are for. And I think this totally qualifies as trademark abandonment. And I've written an open letter at javascript.tm that people can check out, co-signed by Brendan Eich and others, that kind of spells out what the situation is with this JavaScript trademark. I think right now there's over 13,000 signatures on this open letter. And I'm planning on filing a, there's an actual process with the USPTO where you can actually petition for trademark cancellation. The plan is to actually go to them with this evidence and with this open letter and say, hey, I don't think the Oracle's trademark here is right. And you know, we and 13,000 other people working in this space agree with this.
Yeah, I do find it very funny. You can't have JavaScript conference, or I think a while ago, Prime, wasn't it? Some guy made a like mastering JavaScript course.
And Rust for JavaScript devs received a cease and desist from Oracle. This was like 2 years ago. He posted it on Twitter.
Yeah.
Which was funny. We were during the height of the Rust time, so he would have also subsequently got hit with a Rust one right afterwards. It could have been just demolished his course.
Yeah, that was always the funny joke there was if you were going to expect getting sued from one foundation, you're going to expect it from from the Rust side, but then he got blindsided by Oracle cease and desist, and it was like, whoa, that's crazy. Yeah, so I think that's an interesting one, and I love the domain, by the way. Great get on that domain for this. So yeah,
who knew that .tm was a thing? I certainly didn't. It's like Turkmenistan or something. Yeah, I was pleased with that as well.
Yeah. Shifting gears a little bit more towards some Dino and some Dino 2 sort of aspects. One of the things that I found pretty funny from the sort of Dino 2 announcement video, which by the way, loved the like cold open trailer, very fun. You made an excellent salesperson / actor. I don't know what else, marketing whiz. I'm not sure. So that was fun. But one thing that I thought was pretty funny as we were going through is you sort of opened and you were showing off a bunch of Dino 2 stuff in VS Code. Excuse my foul language here. But then I did notice kind of one slip up in the middle, and you opened up NeoVim when you were doing the Next.js thing. And so we're kind of wondering, like, were you told by big Microsoft not to use NeoVim in that announcement?
I am a Vim user. Not even that. I'm trying to transition to NeoVim now, but I'm a longtime Vim user, and my muscle memory is with Vim. I'm like a old school programmer and like don't do fancy things. So like, you know, it was only very recently that I would have like any sort of LSP setup at all with my setup. So my muscle memory is often just drop into Vim and do some stuff, but that is not what most programmers do. Most people are more familiar in VS Code. And of course, I want to show off, LSP stuff in VS Code. And so just to make it more approachable to the audience, use VS Code as much as possible. But yes, yeah, still occasionally that muscle memory drops in.
Yeah, I was just cracking up because you were in the terminal and you could tell it was just one of those things. Oh, I'll throw open a split, open this, change it. Look, it's hot reloading. And I was cracking up from our side on that situation. So I think one of the fun things, you mentioned you're a longtime Vim user. One of the things that I thought was pretty fun was watching some of your original Node announcement talk. And I saw, even though they didn't quite pan over, I was really hoping they'd pan over to showing you in Vim for the IRC demo. I was really interested in sort of the feeling in the room as that IRC demo happened. Was there a shift? Because it felt maybe like at the beginning, not everyone was kind of on board with what you're saying. It's hard to tell from watching the video, but just was my perspective. Did it shift? Was that read on the room correct?
Yeah, that is the greatest demo of my life. I am so happy that you have to remember, this is like 2009, like yep. Wi-Fi barely works. And definitely like at a conference in Berlin is like, very unlikely to work. Shout out to Malta, who I think, spent a lot of time getting all of this conference Wi-Fi stuff working well. Currently the CTO at Vercel. I had this demo planned. It was like a 500 line IRC server written in JavaScript, which in 2009 was just like, holy shit. Like nobody had written a server in JavaScript at all. And like, here's kind of a live, a small little simple IRC server that like people are joining live in a room in Berlin and kind of seeing their messages pop up on screen. It was I was so relieved that it worked, because like there was like a million things out of my control that could have gone totally wrong there. There was definitely a shift in that moment. It's like, oh wow, this is I think people who, it was also a shift for me. Like I had realized at that point that I was onto something with Node, but presenting it to people and like having them understand too, like why this is so exciting. You couldn't build servers like that quickly. Like in 2009, it was like doing something like that involved C and all sorts of stuff. And there was, you could definitely do it, but like it was not like a 500 line JavaScript sort of thing. And just kind of presenting that to web developers, like, I think, that was a home run demo.
So, yeah, and you weren't doing like a live REPL in the C version either, like in the JavaScript one, you sort of get this whole dynamicism that everyone in the audience expects. And that, I think that was,
probably, oh yeah, I think I like dropped into the shell and like kicked somebody out of the server or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. During that presentation, you actually present the ideas of different kind of IOs. For everyone that's not maybe a little bit confused, what we're talking about is 2009. This is like your first Node presentation. You're like, here is Node, the thing I've been cooking for a while. And a large part of this was you convincing the audience that the event loop is correct, which is kind of, I think a lot of people nowadays would find that to be very confusing, because the event loop is very obvious for JavaScript. But back then, that doesn't seem very obvious or very, you can't just intuit that easily. And so how did you kind of come to the conclusion that the event loop was the right way to go?
That was the epiphany, so I had been working, for Engine Yard, actually, if you remember that hosting service, doing a Nginx plugin. And in Nginx, it's all, EPOL and event driven stuff. And so you're writing C and you're having to think in a very different way with kind of, callback pointers it's just a different way of programming. And I found it delightful. I loved how fast Nginx was. It was really, at the same time, I was kind of playing around with Ruby on Rails and kind of a alternative of it called Merb that we were working on and trying to make Ruby on Rails faster, right? And kind of observing that, it's probably still the case in Ruby on Rails. I don't know. It's been a long time, but it could really only handle one request at a time. And that includes like making, connecting to the database and stuff. It was very slow. It was terrible. And when you start thinking about that, you're thinking, well, can't we interleave requests? Can't we just handle more IO here? And, the answer, of course, is kind of event-driven servers. It's kind of a black magic sort of thing back in 2008. There were a couple of projects that were inspiring, Twisted from Python and Event Machine in Ruby. So I was looking at those things, but which are like EPOL plus Ruby, basically, was Event Machine. But you realize that like you can't really take Event Machine and make Ruby on Rails work on top of it, because like all of the infrastructure needs to be non-blocking. And of course, all throughout the Rails code base, there's all sorts of database calls and stuff that are completely synchronous. And you just kind of realize like, oh, there's just no way that this could ever work in a non-blocking way. You would have to restructure the entire code base. You realize that like actually having synchronous code and asynchronous code in the same code base is pretty problematic. And, especially in Ruby, there's no async await at this point. Like there's no nothing, right? Like we just live in a different world. And so maybe hard to imagine. But along comes V8, and suddenly you realize, oh, actually the way that you program websites is really exactly how you should be programming web servers, right? And you have a callback on a button click. You have a callback on when you receive a request. Like that's pretty similar. Like you're kind of structuring your code in terms of callbacks. And in JavaScript, essentially everything's non-blocking, right? Even XHRs have callbacks. Everything is kind of set up to be run, set up in a good way where you could actually multiplex many requests into a single event loop, and take epoll, take v8, smash them together, take a little inspiration from event machine. That is the kind of fundamental epiphany in Node. And yeah, I was excited to share that with people and required a little explanation up front about why you might want to structure your server using epoll versus a thread per request, which was kind of the standard way of doing things.
Fun little story. I got shocked when I found out that it was not a thread per request with Java when I was at Netflix, and totally had a huge bug that hurt production because I was using static data, assuming the whole nature like PHP style and Apache and all that. And so when you're mentioning the Apache in memory going off to infinity, I was just like, oh yes, the good old days of programming. I remember all this. All right. So kind of to switch gears a little bit, at least, colored functions. This is a big thing. Obviously you're talking about async versus having sync and just kind of the mess that is really in a code base. You also use Rust. And Rust has a magical feature where it almost has something like colored structs where you have lifetimes associated with them. So then you can get colored structs with colored functions and it just starts getting really difficult. Have you felt that burden with lifetimes in async? Do you feel like that's really actually a problem? Is it overstated? Because a lot of times these are just technical problems that once you understand it, it's simple. Like, what's kind of been your experience?
Yeah. So I feel like this colored functions thing. So the colored functions, if I'm restate it correctly, is async functions versus non-async functions. And as soon as you have one async function that's colored, has kind of a copyleft effect on it, where like it makes everything else be, everything calling it needs to be async. And so it kind of permeates your code, and people are saying, well, this is kind of unfortunate. And shouldn't we avoid this? I think in practice, like, this is not really a problem so much. I mean, it's not very often in JavaScript that I'm sitting down saying like, oh fuck, like I gotta put another async here. You're just like, whatever. Like, it's kind of a nice, it's nice to have that syntactic signal that like, hey, actually IO is happening in this function. And I think it's async await is pretty minimal. As it goes to Rust and colored structs, this is getting pretty deep. I mean, I we started Dino before there was async await in Rust, and I would say this definitely slowed down things a long time. Like, the first year of Dino was me and Bert basically learning Rust and learning how to juggle a bunch of async functions and futures in Rust. And yeah, it gets pretty headachey. These days, not so bad, or at least we have a pattern that works. You know, Rust is very flexible, and I'm sure you can get into, there's definitely ways you can structure your code that makes it very difficult. But we have a pattern inside of the Dino code base where we effectively have a boxed state that is kind of passed around amongst all of the async functions, and we kind of that ends up solving a lot of these kind of lifetimey sort of issues is just kind of having this essentially global state that's kind of passed through to each function. So I think you can find patterns that make this not really a big problem.
For you, that the box thing, just it like lives for as long as like an isolate or something like that. Is that how they?
Yeah, it's okay. It's attached to the isolate. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That is like when you can sort of know the broader lifetime of something, even if it maybe some of those won't live for the whole time. That makes sense that you can sort of hold on to it for long enough that you can satisfy the borrow checker for everything. I think that's great. Yeah. One of the things, going back to Dino and sort of Dino 2, that I'm interested to get your thoughts and perspectives on, that is at least to my mind pretty unique to Dino, is the idea of sort of permissions and security by default of sort of the runtime itself. I'm just interested to know where you came up with some of those ideas, where you see it being used in Dino, and like ways that people are using that today.
So the security aspect of Dino is, the, you know, the foundation of this idea is just that V8 is JavaScript runtimes in general spend a lot of time thinking about security, right? Web browsers are effectively running untrusted code all day and every day, like in user space. And so V8 is a secure sandbox. And wouldn't it be nice if we could use some of that in server side programming? Shouldn't we kind of strive to keep the same ideals of the web browser, even though it's quite a different situation in servers, kind of similar. So in web browsers, you know, when you web page, front end websites can like access your webcam, for example, and it's not that they just can do that; they have to ask permission in order to access your microphone or your webcam. And we've designed Dino to do a similar sort of thing, but instead of webcam, it's accessing the disk, accessing the network. You basically have to opt into allowing the VM to access these various things. I think some people are a little wish it was better than it is. Like they wish they could apply these permissions at kind of a per module level or per dependency level and say like, oh, you know, this dependency can't access the disk, but this dependency can. We don't know how to do that. And frankly, that, you know, we just don't have the right primitives in V8 to do that sort of thing right now. So we apply these permission checks at a isolate level. So it's the entire process that has access to, well, let's not say the entire process, but the entire thread, the entire V8 isolate that has access to the file system or does not have access. And nevertheless, like that is still pretty helpful. Like even if most of the time you are going to developing, you're going to opt out of this because like you know your code and you're not going to use it. It's pretty nice to be able to kind of check run this and check or you know if you know that you're only making outbound connections to you know api.openai.com like you know whitelist that name and that domain and don't give it access to anything else and let it crash when it does. I like having this kind of extra security sandbox, and it becomes important in our commercial product, you know, Deploy, where you know we are running untrusted servers from multiple people, and do have to worry about kind of securely sandboxing them, and we do make use of V8's secure sandbox, not exclusively. We have other layers of security, but you know, it is a nice tool in the shed.
Yeah, can you talk about, obviously, if anything you can't share, that's totally fine, but like how you use that within your Deploy or like the sub-hosting like product that you guys have? I think both of them are pretty interesting applications.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too deeply about it because I don't want people trying to exploit it. But I'll say broadly that there's kind of two layers of security, and it's broadly structured like Chrome, where kind of you have process level isolation and then you have JavaScript VM level isolation. And we certainly make use of Linux containers and primitives given by the kernel.
Awesome. So just kind of like a question that always is kind of, I think that if you've worked with a lot of JavaScript engines or at least worked with more than one, they have different benefits. So as we kind of went into the modern world of JavaScript, why V8, not JSC or any of the other flavors, QuickJS? Why stick with V8?
I mean, V8's the best, right? It's I think I think, you know, the I guess two answers. One, I am intimately familiar with V8, and just know how to sit at the console of that space shuttle and you know how to tick the switches and stuff. The second is just that there's nothing at all wrong with V8. Like it is, you know, very, very fast. It has all of the features. It's built by a solid team. I think a lot of the, I think a lot of this comes from Bun marketing, to be honest. And you know, I think Bun's in some of these benchmarks where Bun is faster, it's actually the Bun code that is doing the heavy lifting and not the JavaScript runtime, right? I think if they were binding to V8 and doing the same magic that they are, they would also get that performance, right? So yeah, it's yeah. Well, I won't try to diagnose the performance things, but yeah. You know, there is nothing slow about V8. Let's put it that way.
One of the things that I think is pretty cool that Dino has recently done as well is sort of this Rusty V8 project, and that stabilized at 1.0 is my understanding. Well, I guess 129.0.0 or something like this, right? Officially stable. Do you want to talk at all about that? I think people might find that pretty interesting.
Yeah, Rusty V8 is, so V8 is like this massive C++ library. It's like very complicated. There's many thousands of functions, and it is, yeah, V8 is a complicated thing. It is not meant for, it's meant for Chrome and nobody else. So they don't make it particularly nice to be used elsewhere. You know, they in recent years have you know, started to consider some of Node's the impact of their changes on Node, but like, you know, their main customer 99% is Chrome, and you know, they're not trying to make it work for you. and you know, it's C++. It uses a weird build system, Chrome's build system called GN. It just an absolute nightmare to integrate into your project, right? I'll, you know, say the 90% of the battle of Node or Dino is actually like integrating that, you know, Chrome infrastructure into another program. Like the build process is very difficult. Rusty V8 is a binding to Rust, so it binds all of those thousands of functions into Rust. And does this in basically a zero overhead sort of way. The pointers that you handle in C++ in the V8 API is exactly the same thing that you handle in Rust. It does introduce, you know, it does use Rust's type system to its advantage and kind of has an idea of scopes of variables and when things go out of scope. So it's actually easier to wield than the C++ API, where you kind of have to be, I mean, if you're wielding V8 in the first place, like you probably know what you're doing, but let me not make it sound too terrible to work with the C++ API. I mean, all things considered, for what it does, like V8 is fantastic and the API is nice, but we do add like a little bit more with kind of the Rust type system there that, you know, you can kind of tab complete your way to success in many, many ways. So it's essentially a zero overhead binding layer to the V8 C++ API that is available as a Rust crate. It's just called V8. And that is at the core of everything that we're doing in Dino. In Dino, we kind of have a couple of different layers of on top of this. So, you know, there's V8 at its core, C++, and then we add Rusty V8, kind of this thin layer that makes it accessible from Rust. And then we have a thing called Dino Core, which introduces ops, which is kind of our way of binding between Rust and V8. And so there's basically a macro that you can add at the top of functions that turn them into JavaScript. A macro that you add to Rust functions that allows them to be called from JavaScript and does this in a very optimal way. Like we're continually working on this. This is actually where a lot of our engineering effort goes in. Introduces async functions. So async Rust functions actually map to JavaScript async functions. And then on top of that, we add like all sorts of other stuff, the NPM support and different libraries that we implement.
So with all the difficulty, I think I hear a baby somewhere around there. With all the difficulty of just working with V8, I worked at a place that had a lot of V8 integration, and it is a very it's a multi-person effort for quite some time to really be able to get a full-fledged system. Do you ever look at Lua and just kind of yearn for the simplicity of embedding Lua and just using something so simple as that, where you can embed it in an afternoon versus having an entire team dedicated in thousands of functions?
Yes and no. I mean, simplicity is always a goal, and you know, I think something that we should always strive for. But again, it should be as simple as necessary, and not any simpler. And we are not using JavaScript because it's the simplest or nicest language. We're using it because it is the language. JavaScript has all sort of, modern JavaScript is pretty freaking complex. It has WASM, right? V8, there's four different compilers that kind of start at different stages of startup just to optimize the crap out of everything. And at some level you kind of want that. I think when you're dealing with a very simple problem, and Lua could be appropriate, but I mean, also, geez, one indexed arrays. I mean, come on. have I touched on a sore point?
No, it's okay. It's just a long running joke that OneBase makes sense. It's just Big C, the Big C industrial complex, that's tricking all of us into thinking this.
Also, Brazilian elevators go to zero. That's their ground floor, yeah. Zero, not one. So it's actually just natural to start at zero, TJ. We've had this argument going back and forth. Nope. I know, TJ, you're supposed to ask something, but I actually want to cut you off. I know we don't have like a ton of time, and we need to get to the question and answer part, but I do want to hear you talk about JS Zero and JS Sugar, the proposal to split JavaScript in two languages, the one that runs ahead versus the one that engines are implementing.
Yeah, I don't know if I can say anything very intelligent about this. I just saw the slide deck this morning. I kind of like heavy JavaScript, and I like the fact that V8 provides all of these primitives for people. And I don't love the idea of Babel providing all sorts of functionality. Like, mm-hmm. I kind of want the Google C++ engineers to be carefully adding language features, but I'm not sure I totally understand all sides of the argument at this point.
Yeah, before Prime rudely cut me off, I was going to say thank you, since we mentioned Lua.
Hey, thank you. Ryan, thank you. I'd just like to say thank you.
Oh, my goodness. because NeoVim's Lua integration and a bunch of stuff inside of NeoVim is built on top of libuv, which you probably are aware of, I guess, given its history and everything. But it is pretty cool to see a lot of those improvements for that sort of like made Node able to do those things also get shipped inside of NeoVim, running like the main event loop and powering a bunch of stuff inside NeoVim, which is fun.
LibUV is my secret baby, right? It's mm-hmm. it's fun to even early versions of Rust were using LibUV, so it's really fun to see that that library being used in all sorts of places. I think it's one of the standard event loop libraries these days. Mm-hmm. That's delightful.
Yeah. And I don't think, I honestly don't even know if NeoVim would have really been possible without it, just in terms of getting out to Windows and getting, event loops on all these different places and TCP and everything else. So it's very fun, even though, JavaScript is everywhere. Node is still helping out Lua in some way, which is very fun. So from my side, that's a pretty fun thing. So, hey, Prime.
Yeah?
Have you heard of today's sponsor, CodeRabbit?
Let me guess. It's an AI code review tool that people actually use and is good.
Yeah, that's correct.
Let me guess. CodeRabbit's being used in over a million repositories and has reviewed more than 5 million pull requests.
Okay. Two in a row. That's a little weird.
Let me guess, it's not just AI, but there's tools built on top such as AST, grep, linters, and more.
Are you Steph Curry? Because you're hitting every shot.
Let me guess. It works on every major platform. It has enterprise features such as SOC 2, and it has pluggable LLMs.
Okay, are you that Turkish guy, Mr. Shooter? If you know so much about CodeRabbit, what should our listeners do?
They should click the link in the description and install CodeRabbit in their open source repos for free. But seriously, check out CodeRabbit. It's actually really good.
In the description. I think we are now ready to start taking some Q&A questions from chat. So we'll sort of we'll manage those for you and send a few. Send a few your way as they get sent in. One thing that I thought would be kind of fun to talk about while we're waiting for these for some of the first questions to roll in is I've recently taken to somewhat jokingly saying that JavaScript is actually the assembly of the web, because lots of different languages are compiling down to JavaScript. I think of like Gleam is compiling down to JavaScript for one of its runtimes. I'm a big OCaml fan. OCaml has some different ways to compile down to JavaScript. TypeScript is like a way, in a sense, to compile down to JavaScript. I don't know if you have any thoughts about languages targeting JavaScript almost as their runtime to get to the browser. If you have any thoughts in the area.
It's been happening for a long time. I am a fan of making JavaScript good in the first place and making it usable and not kind of building on top of it. So yeah, I really think a lot of these compile to JavaScript things are pretty short lived at the end of the day, because I don't know, it's going to have some other module system. Like, you can't share code very well. Like, they end up being relatively brittle. But I mean, it's pretty clear that JavaScript is the assembly language of the web. And I think that's even more precisely defined in terms of like ASM, JS, and what became WASM and that subset. But frankly, I'm interested in pushing on the actual JavaScript language, which I include TypeScript in, and making that usable for people, because I do believe that it's going to be here not just another year, but you know, potentially for the rest of our lives. And I think that some long-term views on this language are necessary.
All right. Thanks. So some nice questions from the top shelf, which is, are there plans to expand the Dino runtime to support other languages beyond TypeScript and JavaScript?
No, we are going to be adding WASM imports here pretty soon. And of course, you'll be able to compile down to WASM and include that in Dino. As you can in web browsers, but we are building on JavaScript and TypeScript exclusively.
What do you envision for JavaScript and the web dev in general, as in which path should it take?
What path it should take? I'm not sure exactly. I think, you know, that is, I think, what's so exciting of why I work in this space is that there's just so many thousands of people contributing new ideas. For the longest time, I was like hard against JSX. I was like, this is not a standard syntax. Why are we including this in here? This, you know, these elements could be defined in terms of JavaScript syntax. Like, why are we adding this? But like, very clearly, this is a useful thing. And, you know, you find these innovations in different places as people try to build websites with it and invent different syntax changes or different libraries and, yeah, all sorts of different stuff. And it's pretty hard to predict where it's going to go. So, you know, despite there being kind of standards committees that kind of dictate how things should go, I think the real innovation is happening in the framework space and the hosting space for that matter. And it's a little unclear.
So I kind of have I'm reading a question right here, and it actually makes me realize we had a question that I think we were going to ask, but we never quite got around to, which is, the world kind of exists right now as Node. And Dino and Bun, I'd say, are definitely in more of the ancillary roles. Like, that is just not a common thing that people currently pick up right away. Do you think there is a world in which Dino or Bun become more popular than Node?
Yeah, totally. I wouldn't be working on this if I'd thought otherwise. No, there is room for improvement here. Like, this is not a static state. Like, we are building for the long term, and I think things like JSR show how delightful it could be. Like, it doesn't need to be this terrible. It could be very delightful. It's going to take a little time for that to percolate through the world. I think it's inevitable that we're going to have a plurality of ways to run JavaScript server side, just like it happens in the browsers.
Nice. So let's assume I'm completely new to programming in the JS world. Why would I pick Dino over Node or Bun when I'm coming from a no knowledge standpoint?
Yeah, I think that's the main reason you should be picking up a Dino. It is like an all-inclusive setup. So there is literally one file, dino.exe, and this gives you everything you need for development. So you gives you your code format, you know, obviously execution. It gives you type checking. It gives you code formatting. It gives you linting. It hooks into your IDE. It defines how you set up your project structure. It, you know, even allows you to publish to JSR. Like, this single executable file is your complete development toolkit for JavaScript and TypeScript. And that, I think, for somebody coming from a different language who doesn't know what prettier is just such a relief, right? Like, I think as people who work in the JavaScript world, like, you just kind of get used to this. You're like, yeah, of course you use prettier. Of course you use ESLint. But if you're coming at this from, you know, C# or whatever, like, you're just walking into this world with all of these terms and stuff that you're just like, I don't know how to even start a project. What, you know, you have to, there's a lot of knowledge that goes into just opening, you know, how do you start a simple library and publish it? Like, good luck. There's just, you know, you're going to have to sift through 10 years of blog posts and try to figure out the right way of doing it. And there's, you know, a dozen different ways, and you know, 11 of those are absolutely wrong. And there's one way, but, you know, it involves like 20 different dot files in your directory. Let's just get rid of that. Like it doesn't need to be this way. Like, just write some TypeScript, export a function, you know, open it up in VS Code, do your type checking, publish it to JSR. Like, it just can be so much simpler. So, I like to say Dino is for the children. It's for people who are not steeped in Node-isms, and you should be able to approach it with essentially zero knowledge.
Yeah, it is very pleasant, like, just downloading Dino, and then I was going. You know, I didn't have to think, oh, I'm like, I know a bunch of the words. You know, I know what prettier is, I know what ESLint is, and I still can't install them correctly anytime I start a Node project. Like, I never install enough of the right things, or they're the wrong versions, or whatever. And so I will say it's a really nice experience out of the box, starting with Dino, and just, it's just like working.
And if you don't know it, then just imagine like somebody from, you know, some novice doing this. Like, it's just, you just hit a wall of mm-hmm. like, yeah.
Speaking of that, this is kind of an off topic question. Well, it's very on top and off of the Q&A. Void Zero has now been kind of approaching this unification of tooling. What do you kind of think about that? Because this is obviously, we are all fairly experienced, and we all know it's non-trivial to really get a fully featured JavaScript application off the ground. What do you think about Void Zero?
It sounds like a great effort. So Dino 2, we removed the Dino bundle subcommand because we realized bundling is just a really hard problem in general. We had a pretty simple one. It would, you know, take your main.ts file and like bundle up all of your dependencies. That's not everything. That's not the end all and be all of bundling. Like in general, bundling for a website can be a pretty complicated undertaking. So we are acknowledge that this is a main part of kind of the JavaScript tool chain, but don't quite know how to do it. And I think you know, Evan and the new Void Zero company have very good ideas of how to do this. Same with linting. So we are looking really closely at OXC and which is a Rust parsing library for JavaScript. We use SWC, and we're kind of asking ourselves, maybe OXC is the right train to be on. Like this is potentially grounds for switching for us. So yeah, we're pretty interested in working with Evan and whatever the Void Zero company turns out to be with provide linting and bundling. It seems, you know, we generally focus on code execution, and if they have better solutions for that tooling, like I would be very eager to work with them.
If Dino becomes an all-encompassing JavaScript runtime, the soup du jour of all the JavaScript runtimes, will you ever have like the linter, the prettier, all the things built into a singular LSP that us NeoVimmers and VS Coders could enjoy alike?
Yes, I mean, we do. That is how Dino works now.
All right, well, awesome. Sorry, I'm reading from the top shelf. I didn't realize that. Great.
I'll ask one then. That's a better question. Nice try, Prime. One thing that I think is an interesting question in here is, how do you envision Dino's approach to WebAssembly if WebAssembly ever actually becomes a thing? And how might it impact Dino as a secure runtime?
I think WebAssembly has been overhyped in recent years, and there's been a bunch of companies trying to bring this to server side, and I think they have not been incredibly successful at this. Because, well, I have a lot of thoughts about this, but
share on.
Well, you know, I think most people developing for the web are writing in JavaScript, and this their development cycle, their edit loop does not have a compile step in it, right? They're using HMR, they're using Next.js, they're just like they move very, very fast, and the kind of WASM server side services are like, hey, wouldn't it be great if you could compile your JavaScript along with QuickJS into WASM? It will run slower, and now you have a compile step, and now you get to upload this binary. Isn't that great? And people are just like, but why? But I can just push to Vercel, and it works really great. So it's kind of, you know, it's, I think the WASM services are imagining this, you know, dreaming of this future where everybody writes their server code in Rust, and that there's really like a market for you know, Rust optimized server, you know, edge functions that run in WASM. But I think that just doesn't match with reality, because, you know, the people developing this are wanting to develop in a dynamic language. They don't want a compile step. They want this all to be super fast. Yeah, frankly, don't have the performance concerns to justify moving it into Rust. And so I think that on top of that, like, a WASM is just early for where it's at. And I think a lot of the you know, bindings into the operating system are just not working perfectly well. So yeah, to come back to your question, how will Dino interoperate with this? Yeah, of course, V8 can execute WASM and is putting a lot of work into this. It's probably the best WASM execution engine. And we are, you can do this in Dino today. You can open up a WASM file and execute it in your JavaScript program. We will be making this easier by allowing you to import WASM directly with an import statement into your code. So this should be you know, you won't have kind of runtime dynamic loading of a WASM file and execution like that, but rather it'll be part of your module graph. So that should make it a lot nicer. I could see it, you know, one could imagine ways to go beyond this, even where, you know, Dino kind of understands Rust to a certain degree and could like compile that down to WASM for you so that you could like import Rust. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. And honestly, I don't think that's a main concern for most JavaScript users. So, I'm going to tiptoe into WASM stuff, make it slightly nicer here, but I kind of want to see where this is going yet. And I think we have yet to see a real necessity for WASM frankly, anywhere.
I think you really nailed it with just especially with the edge functions and all that. Often a lot of these functions are not like large applications. They have to be pretty constrained. They're doing a bunch of async work and kicking off some stuff and returning a result that feels very naturally JavaScript. I wouldn't architect my, Rust over to do these like just tiny operations. It just feels like a funny operation to have this WASM trying to like invert the operations there. This one might be a bit controversial for you, but that Bun is very, we could say, like more vocal on Twitter. They use Twitter more often. I see their tweets more frequently. I rarely ever see a tweet from the Dino side of the world. Do you think there's value in being in kind of like the tech Twitter space and maybe we can't call it necessarily dunking, but more of that environment, right? Which is like, HTMX makes a joke and then Bun says, delete yourself or delete this account, right? Like there's like a lot of heavy interaction with the community by a Bun, but I just don't feel like I see that ever with Dino. Do you think there's value there? Are you missing something?
Maybe. I mean, marketing is certainly important. And, we did this whole cold open video it helps people think about the product, right? I'm not going to say that marketing is unimportant. It's very important. I don't really follow the Twitterverse tech community maybe as deeply as you guys do, so I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but I come from a bit of an academic background. I find this a little distasteful, just kind of like telling people delete themselves or whatever. So that's not my kind of preferred medium of interaction. But it's also fun to have like fun memes and stuff. And our YouTube channel definitely tends in that direction, kind of fire ship style videos and stuff. It's fun. It's not hanging out on Twitter all day though is not exactly my vibe.
That's understandable. TJ, do you have anything left?
Yeah, they didn't directly ask it. People were asking about sort of full stack TypeScript applications. You got any spoilers for us for Fresh 2? Anything coming down the pipeline or anything?
It's coming soon. We've been working on this Dino 2 release and Fresh didn't make it for that. The big feature that we're trying to get in there is support for component libraries. So Fresh uses Preact, and what we need to be able to do is, all of these component libraries are using React, of course, and like importing React. And we need to have a way to kind of patch those React imports with Preact Compat. And we kind of have this functionality, but not working perfectly now. And so just adding that, getting that working nicely is kind of the holdup for Fresh 2. But I think it should be coming out, by the end of the year, definitely. But yeah, we have yet to have like a hard roadmap on it.
Cool. Well, thanks. I think that's pretty much everything from our side. So we really appreciate you coming out and taking the time to chat with us about all the way, the beginnings of Node to Dino 2 and a bunch of stuff going on there. Anything else you want to sort of give a shout out or for anybody to be looking out for or I mean, obviously they should try Dino too. I tried it and it's, I will say, unbiased. I'm not really a JavaScript guy. It was very easy to use and I liked that. So I'll give my own personal recommendation for people to give it a go. But anything else people should check out?
Check out Dino 2. Yeah, we're striving to keep things simple. Look at JSR. Whatever. That's my only call outs. Yeah. thanks guys. It's a fun conversation.
Awesome. I mean, feel free to use and abuse this time to make any call out you want. Do not feel bad. You don't have to keep it short. If there's anything special, go for it. Follow you on Twitter.
Well,
right?
I am on Twitter now, as of earlier this year.
YouTube channel.
I'm rough.
You have a YouTube channel.
Rough underscore C if you want to follow. And yeah, look out for trademark stuff. I'm about to wrestle this JavaScript trademark out of a big publicly traded company. So more on that soon.
We'd love to see it.
Awesome. Well, thanks. And we really appreciate your time and we'll be looking forward to that trademark stuff. And I am still just so impressed with the domain name. I'm a big fan of getting a great domain name. Not that I ever ship anything, but like if I was going to, it would have a great domain name. So really, really think that's great. So thanks. Thanks, Ryan. And thanks, Prime, for being here and interrupting me a bunch of times, too. Of course, it was good.
Thank you. Yeah, that was awesome. All right, cool. Ryan, if you could stick around for a moment. Bye, everybody. Bye, chat. Bye, YouTube. Like and subscribe to the Dino YouTube channel. Please go find them. Like all their videos. Subscribe. Become a member. $1.99 a month or whatever it is. Get after it.